It's time to bring in David Taracek with the Media Beat. David joins us on a Friday morning, and we take a look at the media coverage of different events. David has his own website, themediabeat.us. He's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. And we say, good morning, David. Are you in the woods or in the media capital?
No, I'm glad to be reporting in again on the Media Beat from Maine instead of my more usual base in the media capital of the world, New York City. And I am pleased, of course, once again to be joining the always healthy, skeptical Marshall Miles. Let's talk about economic coverage, shall we, Marshall?
Yeah,
let's
absolutely.
Start with a surprise, something indeed somewhat counterintuitive. Some good news from Wall Street this week. Don't worry if you missed it, because everybody else did, too. I mean, so says MarketWatch, anyway, the online finance news source that's celebrating its 25th anniversary this year. You know, MarketWatch used to be known as CBS MarketWatch when I worked at the CBS News Network in the 1990s. The MarketWatch broke the mold then, offering real-time trading information, which was previously only available, do you remember, to people who had those expensive commuter terminals like Reuters, Bloomberg, and Dow Jones. Well, MarketWatch, all these years later, is now owned by Dow Jones. Of course it is. I mean, financial Goliaths remain Goliaths, even if you try and outmaneuver them like MarketWatch did. Anyway, that somewhat unnoticed bit of good news of the week, among all the general pessimistic talk of recession and inflation, MarketWatch was actually highlighting this. Inflation expectations in the investment world remain far lower than the worst-case scenarios we keep hearing about from so many people, that things are bound to get even more terrible. Surprising good news, again quoting MarketWatch, that's their description, it comes courtesy of one of the most important reports of the month, the Bank of America Securities ongoing global survey of fund managers just about everywhere. Every month the bank strategists will poll major money managers around America and overseas as well, to find out what they're thinking and how they're currently investing. This month, the bank asked over 250 pension fund managers and chief investment officers, the like, who are collectively handling, they say, over $700 billion in assets. And this is the result. Everyone, I'm quoting directly again, everyone expects inflation to fall. That's what the bank strategy team wrote in the summary. Those managers expecting inflation to fall greatly outnumbered those who were expecting anything else, like a moderate fall or staying steady. That consensus on lower inflation, the Bank of America is saying, is the strongest since the global financial crisis of 2008, the whole lifetime of MarketWatch itself, just about. That's what money managers are thinking. I think the reading, viewing, or listening public, however, is another matter entirely, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And you know, another thing about people and the stock market. Most people don't really know that the stock market, as an indicator itself, is very limited in what it indicates, and it's not this all expansive. I think people who aren't familiar with the stock market think that the Dow Jones Industrial Average and NASDAQ and everything covers multiple things of the economy all across the country, and of course it doesn't.
Sure. Wall Street is not the economy. But, of course, in judging whether to buy or sell, money managers have to take into account all those elements that do make up the economy. So, you know, it's a helpful It's like a straw in the wind. It helps you see which way the wind is blowing, but it's not the only thing it tells you. But the essential thing that comes out of watching the market or watching the people who are in the market is that it does provide these signs, and politicians jump on these signs and exploit them as much as they can. You can expect, in this case, for instance, Democrats to be falling over themselves to use that kind of prediction from the Bank of America, along with all the big political news of yesterday, and we'll get onto that in a minute, to persuade the public that their fears about inflation are not so justified. Now, that's a hard sell to people who in their everyday, ordinary lives, with grocery bills and prices at the gas pump have been going up. The news from yesterday that I've been thinking about was, of course, that Democrat leaders do seem to have convinced one target audience. I mean, a target of one person, indeed. I'm talking inevitably about that lone figure of Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia, who I see the New York Times keeps on calling Senator Joe Manchin III of West Virginia. Don't let's forget that suffix. Manchin agreed suddenly to a deal with his caucus leader, Chuck Schumer, that he will now support the Biden administration in its scaled back since last year, that is, of climate change measures, which Manchin has never really liked at all, combined with some curtailing of healthcare policies, which he has wanted, of course. Manchin was earlier blocking the whole package. Now he's changed his mind. It's a big Washington story. Fans of political thriller fiction might be tempted to wonder what Schumer might have on Manchin to make him do this. 180. Maybe he's blackmailing him with compromising photographs. It's rather doubtful, I'd say. But it was certainly a remarkable turnaround, and Democratic leaders are obviously hoping, as they brief journalists continually on these still ambitious new measures in the big package, that by looking like they're taking inflation really seriously, that they will do better in the upcoming midterm elections. That's the biggest thought at the back of their minds, or in the forefront of their minds.
You know, when we talk about the economy, and I love this country, and I love most countries like in Europe and here, they tend to blame the economy on the person who's at the top of the government, completely overlooking what's going on in China, the world's second biggest economy, and what's going on there. That is absolutely stunning. That well-oiled machine is slowly screeching to a halt with not only what's going on with the world economy, but with the unbelievable graft that goes on in that country.
Sure, yeah, and got to the point now where you have an extraordinary measure to basically just leave the property development sector of the Chinese economy, which is a huge element of it, alone as it has collapsed, leaving it alone in the sense that they're lifting the obligation of people to continue paying their mortgages. All debts are sort of frozen now in that really important area of the Chinese economy. And as I was hearing only this morning, a radio commentator specializing in the economics was pointing out that this inevitably will have ripples around the rest of the world. It's hard to calculate quite what those ripples will be, but China is such an economic force in the world as a whole that you certainly can't do what is tempting to do, because this in China is so much of a special case in every way, to sort of put them on one side of the ledger. You can't. There are bound to be to and fro impacts from what is happening in China. Not just this particular problem of a kind of freeze on debt. All these unbuilt buildings just abandoned. The Chinese landscape is dotted with them, and I'm reminded in seeing those images, looking at of the time when we could, as I did, look at the economic impact of a recession, because that's what it was then. Absolutely undebatable, unquestionable state of recession in Greece, when you remember they had their terrible economic problems in the 80s. There were buildings left spookily all over the Greek landscape with reinforced concrete, with the iron bars inside the reinforced concrete sticking up into the sky, very strangely and spookily, almost skeletal-like, as almost a, well, literally a concrete symbol of a frozen economy. And what we'll see now, I suspect, from China is the overall slowing down of the Chinese economy is bound to have its effects on the rest of it.
It's amazing to look at, and what's interesting, and they could probably make a lot of money with zombie movies in China by letting companies come in and film. Literally, I think there's 25 already built in the past couple of years cities with train stations, with apartment buildings, with malls, all empty. All empty. It's absolutely. It's absolutely stunning when you take a look at it. I mean, it's stunning when you take a look at the cities that have prospered in the past 20 years, but it's even more stunning to look over the past 5 years, the empty cities that they built that are just sitting there. It goes to show you if Americans really looked at that the people that wanted a global economy have succeeded, because that's what we have right now. Everybody is dependent on other people, whether you're a communist, whether you're a liberal, whether you're progressive, whether you're a dictator. It doesn't matter. It's all linked together via business, and it's a small.
The law of unintended consequences is prevailing here, isn't it?
It is amazing. Want to go?
I remember at the time. By the way, I was in the forefront, you might say, in terms of the kind of television program making that I was engaged in the 80s. And globalization was taking off, and it looked into many people's eyes as if we were being some kind of propagandists for this movement for globalization. That's not quite correct. We in fact had a different word for trying to describe what was happening in our neck of the woods when we were making all these documentaries about the developing world and its relationship with the developed world. The word we used wasn't globalization, it was interdependence. I don't want to say I told you so, but I mean that is turning out to be a much better description, and has turned out to be a much better description in the long run. We're not just one world. It's not as simple as that. We are incredibly interdependent upon each other, and that's certainly playing out now. As the American public confronts this extraordinary question of where is our economy going, it's really a matter of what people feel about it, much more than what facts and what numbers can be trotted out. And trying to tackle the issue of people's feelings about the economy is a huge challenge for those Democrats I was talking about, who are hoping to, you know, get some kind of a turnaround in public opinion and come through the midterms to survive and hopefully get more representation in Congress that will make it a better place for them to operate, instead of being frozen all the time as it has been. So rolling out Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary and the White House's Chief Economic Advisor, to talk to the media this week has absolutely been prioritized. And they repeat again and again that even if technically we might seem to be in a recession, because we've had shrinkage in economic growth for six successive months, that's the classic defining factor, we're not really in a recession. Well, that's an argument that can go on, I guess. But I mean, since there's a growth, strong growth in job numbers, low numbers for unemployment, and this is really important since the engine of America's economy is consumerism, after all, consumer spending remains high. Although it's favoring services that we buy more than the goods that get produced and we buy as regular consumers, it's all a hard sell. But of course, they're trying that hard sell very determinedly.
I want to move on to a couple of other subjects that we can talk about, and that is China and Nancy Pelosi and Joe Biden. I tend to think that Nancy Pelosi will not be going to Taiwan.
Well, it's another one of those tough sells. It's important that we stand with Taiwan. That's been American foreign policy for a long time, even though, you know, we, the United States, as a member of the United Nations, got around eventually to, you know, willingly see the Taiwan seat at the United Nations taken away from them and given to the People's Republic of China. That's a kind of realpolitik that's facing the brutal reality of facts on the ground, which is that, you know, People's Republic is a much bigger entity than little island Taiwan. And, you know, the big countries are the bullies in the world, as gets demonstrated again and again, like in the Russian invasion of Ukraine. But that realpolitik is likely to prevail, I think, as you suggest, that mainland China's aggressive objections to that kind of American approach to Taiwan, reasserting what China sees as an unjustifiable claim to existence by Taiwan as an independent entity. They claim it as part of their own, of course. Is bound to have its impact. On the other hand, you know, it's very redolent of a campaign that Communist China has done frequently in the past on a slightly different issue, but the principle of its behavior is pretty much the same. You know, you'll remember, of course, and it still happens whenever the Dalai Lama from Tibet, subject nation of Communist China, is visiting. The degree of warmth with which he is welcomed in the West is always a bit of a red flag to the bull of bullying Communist China. Many countries have caved on that issue because of China, and it'll be interesting to see if America, if not caving, is certainly adjusting its intentions towards its public attention towards Taiwan in the shape of the Speaker of the House. And it's her decision, of course, but I think you may be right.
She'll send some lower level staffers and everything, and she won't go. I mean, there's so many different ways around it that you can please the Chinese. And then we'll go to Russia and the Ukraine, because the United States, and I've said this, I posted this and I've talked about it. I have no idea how a very smart athlete who goes to play with Russian players in Russia, very smart, very talented, can make the mistake she made, which puts this country now in the position where we're going to have to trade people to get her and a Marine back, a former Marine who are being held prisoner. You add the Ukraine crisis in here, and you just wonder you can blame a lot of things on the Russians, but if you're a famous American and you go to Russia right now, and if you're American plane, they're going to follow you. They need every up they can get, and this whole situation is just so far out of hand.
Sure. Prisoner swaps are always a grim exercise. I don't think we ever end up with a deal with whether it was the Soviet Union or capitalist Russia now. But those deals do need to be made. One negotiator commented just this week that if you're confronted with whether you get two American citizens out or whether you do some deal that is horrible in the sense that, you know, as in this case, the cost of that deal is to release a pretty hideous arms dealer convicted in slam dunk evidence, and that seems like a really dirty deal. But if you're confronted with the choice between a dirty deal and getting two Americans out, getting the two Americans out is the more important of the two consequences, and I can understand that, particularly if you're the United States State Department. It was ever this. I mean, this is one point to remember. I mean, we may complain about the conditions that are making us, or the events, or the individual decision making. You know, as in the case of Brittany Griner herself and what she did and what she's admitted to. Whatever that. However those bits of information stack up in our considerations, the main thing is, what do we do now? Yeah. And even with a state of war in place, Russia invading Ukraine and the United States getting more and more involved in the supplying of more sophisticated weaponry to the Ukraine side in that conflict, it does seem as if, it is very clear that we are prepared to do a deal with Russia. We're still waiting for Russia to come back with its final answer. But the very fact that the United States Secretary of State has gone public with this is clearly indicating that an agreement is in the machinery. It's in the works, and we can expect it at some point to come through.
And
all those deals negotiated in the past by Bill Richardson, for instance, a retired diplomat who has a specialty of negotiating the release of hostages, if you like, in foreign parts. That's a full-time job for many people, and we'll see. I think a resolution here that we may not like, but at least, as I say, yeah, two unjustly imprisoned Americans will get to go home.
And finally, with the U.S. and Russia in Ukraine, it appears that the weapons that have been supplied that are now being used have really changed what has happened in the eastern Donbas region and the southern region, southeastern region, where actually now Ukraine is gaining back some of the land it lost, and once again they have cut off Russians who opened up that land bridge. Well, they've now cut that land bridge off by taking out two bridges. I mean, a stunning turnaround when you look at what's going on, and you just wonder how much longer Russia and the people in Russia will accept this.
Well, it's an autocratic regime, and it can suppress public opinion quite effectively. But as you say, for how long? That's the question. When you get particular battles like the one now for Kherson, it is a remarkable tribute to Ukraine's resilience, and of course to the Western support that it's getting in effecting that resilience, and the fight back is extraordinary in the annals of a lot of European wartime campaigns. It's a matter really of how long this slog can continue. It calls for one of those pullbacks to a 30,000 feet kind of view and say, well, how you, Ukrainians are making an extraordinary fight back. Yes, they are, but the Russian military machine still seems sullenly plugging along, slogging, in a way, and of course, committing all the war crimes it does as it goes. And this can't go on forever.
Yeah.
Every war must end, and every war must end with some form of talking. And that's kind of within view. To borrow some terminology from the intractable Middle East problem of Arabs and Israelis, the horizon of some kind of settlement has to be there on the landscape somewhere. And I think we may be in sight of seeing it.
David, it's always great to talk with you. Have a great weekend, and we'll check with you next week.
I look forward to that.
And David Tarachuk with The Media Beat. You can find David on his website, themediabeat.us, and you can find him here at robinhoodradio.com. Click on On Demand. Click on The Media Beat with David Tarachuk.